Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Restaurant owners are having a hard time finding and keeping staff more than a year into the COVID-19 pandemic. They say many workers left the industry for better pay or more stability, and that's making it hard to staff enough people to keep operations running smoothly. But restaurant workers, current and former, say COVID is not entirely to blame. They say the industry has always had its share of issues. Dana Vollmer has the story.
Danny G worked full-time at McDonald's in Bloomington when the pandemic hit. Within a week, her hours got cut from 35 down to just 5 or 6. That was unsustainable for Danny, who asked that we only use her first name to protect her employment. To fill the gap, Danny picked up work at Under the Ground Buono, a vegan and vegetarian meal prep service. Danny says it was a bit of a culture shock in the best way possible. She was getting paid $1.50 over minimum wage, and she felt like her employer cared about her well-being for the first time. Danny remembers having to call out of work after suffering an allergic reaction.
I didn't have to provide a doctor's note for my boss. I was like, hey, I've got this, you know, allergy. And they're like, okay, cool, just take a day off. Not only did they give me the day off, but for the first time in my life, I got paid sick leave. And so that was a really big concern of mine because I wasn't sure how I was going to be able to pay my bills without that.
At her fast food job, Danny says calling out sick could have gotten her in trouble, on top of losing out on much-needed money. She left fast food for a while during the pandemic, but recently rejoined McDonald's. Danny says they tried to get her back for minimum wage, and she said no. Then, a few days later, they bumped up the wage out of desperation.
We just hired 10, 15 people about a month ago, and none of them still work for McDonald's because they found other jobs that are willing to pay them well over minimum wage, not in the fast food industry. It's a horrible work. I get yelled at. I get cussed out. I get food thrown at me on a daily basis, and I shouldn't have to put up with that for minimum wage.
Danny says the mental and physical toll is exhausting, especially when they're constantly short-staffed.
People that have been there for a while are quitting now because they're burnt out. I've had my coworkers sitting in a chair crying. I've seen my coworkers just break down, walk out of the store. I don't blame them because it's frustrating. McDonald's is expecting us to work in an environment where we're being overworked, underpaid, and it's really hard to accomplish.
Restaurant workers say those problems aren't exclusive to fast food. Creighton Budris took his first restaurant job last summer as a dishwasher at a locally owned restaurant downtown. He only lasted 3 months.
It was just not worth the money for how hard the work was. And once the pandemic was really in full swing and it was clear how unsafe they were being, I didn't feel like it was worth risking my safety or spending my time for such little reward. I haven't really had a physically harder job than that, just hunched over a sink for 8 hours.
Budris says servers would come in the back and take their masks off immediately. He says none of the cooks or managers wore a mask either. Budris says COVID safety precautions aren't much better at the vape shop he works for now, but other parts of the job are more manageable, and the pay is comparable. Some restaurant owners claim people don't want to take their jobs because pandemic relief and unemployment payments are equivalent to restaurant wages. Budris disagrees.
The idea that people are, like, by and large, just on unemployment, that's really silly. The unemployment system is really, really, really hard in this state. It takes forever to get it, and they kick you off of it on a moment's notice and then make you go through the whole process again. So no one wants to do it.
Restaurant work can be lucrative, particularly for tipped employees like servers. Michael Swanson left a job at Walmart to start serving at a corporate restaurant in March.
Ever since I started, like, business has been booming. There's times where I go into work and, you know, the hosts are already asking me, hey, do you want to take a table? And I haven't even clocked in yet.
Swanson has worked in restaurants on and off in the past. He says switching to retail gave him another perspective on low-wage jobs.
Having to go to work, driving across town for, you know, a 15-minute commute one way, work for $11 an hour, and not even getting full time and barely able to meet your expenses when you have creditors calling you and breathing down your back. It really takes a toll on you mentally as much as it does physically. Now, in comparison, I'm about 3 weeks into being a server at this restaurant, and I've already been able to make enough money to pay my bills.
But Swanson says that's not the case everywhere. He says one of the most difficult things about restaurant work is the inconsistency of customers and their tips. On employer wages alone, Swanson says it's unsustainable. The minimum wage for tipped restaurant workers is 60% of what other hourly workers make. The tipped minimum wage in Illinois is currently $6.60. It's gradually increasing along with the hourly wage. Swanson says if he had his way, restaurant workers would be paid the hourly minimum and still be able to make tips.
Honestly, for the work that servers have to do alongside the rest of the restaurant staff, I don't think they get paid enough to deal with half the things that they have to deal with. Especially that coming from someone who had like a year and a half break from the industry.
On top of low pay, Swanson says the workplace culture can be a nightmare depending on the restaurant.
Sometimes you can luck out and you'll get a staff of people that are genuinely there to enjoy the industry, do the work, make people happy, and feed the community. And then, you know, there's people that are absolute party animals, and, you know, you get a whole mix of people depending on where you go.
Swanson says he has limited sympathy for restaurant owners who say they can't find workers. He says if restaurants can't afford to pay workers a living wage, they shouldn't be in business.
You can't be mad if one of your workers gets poached by Target because Target pays better. You found the issue of why they got poached, and now you as a business owner have to make that response.
Restaurant workers say these problems won't go away with the pandemic. They say the restaurant industry has reached a point of reckoning. Higher pay is a start, they say, but to truly make the industry sustainable for employees, they're looking for benefits like health insurance, retirement plans, and parental leave. I'm Dina Vollmer.
You're listening to Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. BNA's educational video series, Hear My Story, continues with local patient Gina Barnhart.
It sounds funny, but I feel more independent because I can actually hear people and I have more confidence in that. It's such an empowering feeling.
Gina's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Rivian's plans to sell insurance for its electric vehicles are now taking shape. New details are being released about data-driven coverage in a partnership with established underwriter Nationwide. Rivian was already at the forefront of electrification and autonomous driving. Now it appears to be on the leading edge of another trend, car makers that sell insurance, too. That carries special meaning in Bloomington Normal, where State Farm is based and where Rivian will make its EVs. Rivian recently announced plans to sell insurance products as part of its digital ordering process. The company says by linking insurance to the vehicle itself, they'll be able to diagnose issues more quickly and comprehensively and even remotely. And those who use Rivian's mid-level autonomous driving tool can get discounts on their rates. Customers will also be able to insure their home, recreational equipment, and other vehicles, aka bundling. Rivian insurance will be available to customers in 40 states initially, and the policies will be underwritten by third-party carriers. Rivian hasn't disclosed who they will be, but Nationwide has confirmed to WGLT that it is a partner. It's unclear if there are others. What Rivian is doing is not entirely new. EV pioneer Tesla started selling insurance to California vehicle owners in 2019 through its partner, State National, and GM recently launched data-driven coverage via its OnStar insurance subsidiary. The reason it's possible is because of telematics, also known as usage-based insurance, or UBI. It's a trend that's grown within the insurance business in the last decade or so. Basically, it's technology inside of your car that can track how fast you accelerate or how hard you brake. In other words, how risky you are. With super-connected vehicles like Rivian's, there is just simply more data available. Sam Abu-Samad is principal analyst for e-mobility at Guidehouse, based in Detroit.
You know, I think we're going to continue to see more of this. The automakers have access to that data, and they can work with, you know, the insurance providers to be able to give an opportunity for the customers to maybe get lower premiums if they, you know, if their driving behavior indicates a lower risk of getting into crashes or lower claim risk.
Drivers are warming up to the idea. Survey results from May 2020 showed about half of drivers were comfortable sharing their data with their insurer. That's according to Mark Friedlander, a spokesperson for the Insurance Information Institute, an industry think tank. That grew significantly during the pandemic.
UBI was a key factor for U.S. auto insurers in providing $14 billion in premium relief to drivers last year, where they gave refunds and credits on auto insurance policies because UBI was used to indicate how much less drivers were in their vehicles, how much less they were using their vehicles.
Rivian didn't respond to WGLT's request for comment for this story, but experts say there are a few different reasons why it would want to sell insurance. Electric vehicle customers, including Teslas, have often complained about getting slammed with higher rates. There may also be an opportunity for a little extra revenue. Sam Abulsamid with Guidehouse says typically there's some sort of revenue-sharing model between the automaker and its third-party carrier.
The car makers are essentially acting as brokers here more than insurance companies. And, you know, so they, you know, may get a share of the premium payments as long as the customer stays with that program. So it's another potential revenue stream for the automakers.
And as a marketing tool, Rivian can argue that tying together insurance and the vehicle will produce a better customer experience. Every Rivian vehicle is equipped with the company's Driver Plus suite of safety technology. Rivian insurance customers will automatically get a Driver Plus rate reduction in addition to any discounts that come their way from using a feature that automatically steers and adjusts speed on the highway. Yaowan Ren is an associate professor in risk management and insurance at ISU's College of Business.
So they can provide a lot of services to their customers, and they can develop a one-stop shop business model for their customers.
There is disagreement about whether plans like Rivian's pose a competitive threat to legacy auto insurance companies like State Farm or Allstate. Presumably, a customer could just decline Rivian insurance, go out in the open market and buy a policy, no middleman.
They definitely pose the competitive threat to the existing insurance industry, not just the insurance industry, but also the auto industry. They bring competition to this industry, so it's beneficial to customers.
Mark Friedlander with the Insurance Information Institute disagrees. After all, Rivian isn't actually underwriting those policies. A traditional insurer is still getting business.
This is a new way to market your business to drivers. It's expanding the marketplace that is already out there for telematics and making it easier for drivers to access coverage. So clearly it's an add-on, it's complementary to what's already out there in the marketplace. We don't see it as competition.
Rivian will be making its electric vehicles at its normal manufacturing plant. It expects to have about 1,800 employees by June. First vehicles get delivered to customers this summer. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Illinois will lose one congressional district next year. It's up to the Democrat-controlled legislature to determine which seat is removed. John Shaw, director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, tells Eric Stock he expects Democrats will eliminate one of two congressional districts in Southern Illinois that would force two Republican incumbents, Mike Bost and Mary Miller, to potentially run against each other next year for a seat Democrats don't expect to win.
I think it's very, very likely that the lost Illinois congressional seat is going to come in downstate Illinois. I think that's almost certain. And there are several downstate Republicans whose districts are likely to be carved up in a way that is advantageous for the Democratic Party.
McLean County has one of those oddly shaped districts where Rodney Davis has a portion of Bloomington Normal in the 13th district, and the rest of the county goes to Darren LaHood of the 18th district, and LaHood's seat is overwhelmingly Republican. Do you see that changing, given that to give Democrats a chance at greater victories, they almost have to concede a couple of districts for Republicans?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Democratic map makers are looking hard at the 18th district, the 13th, the 15th, and the 12th, And seeing how the map can be reshaped to do a couple of things. One, I mean, if Illinois needs to lose a congressional seat, it's going to occur in that, you know, southern half of the state almost certainly. So the map makers are trying to at least preserve their power base and if anything, expand it. So, you know, this is probably not a good year to be a Republican incumbent or, you know, a representative in a district, a Republican representative in a district in the southern half of the state, because, you know, notions of what is a fair map are likely to be challenged. And I think that, you know, when you look at some of the future district downstate coming, you know, after the census, there's likely to be a very, very, very large district that covers a big chunk of the southern, almost the southern half of the state.
We also heard the potential that Republicans would want to carve out Adam Kinzinger's congressional district because the party is upset with his vocal opposition to former President Trump. Given the GOP may have a little say in this process, do you see that as any possibility, or would that be something the Democrats would look to do?
First of all, I don't think the Democratic leadership, they frankly probably like having Kinzinger there as kind of a thorn in the side and stirring things up in the Republican Party. I mean, I think the congressman's greater problem or greater threat to his political career is a primary challenge next year in which more conservative elements of the Republican Party, or at least the Trump, you know, faction of the party, goes after him because of his comments on the president. So I can't see Democrats necessarily trying to do anything to make his life more difficult, because I think, frankly, they kind of like having him in the position that he's in.
Governor J.B. Pritzker campaigned on fair maps. He ran an independent campaign financially. He was not beholden to anybody. The power structure in Springfield has since blown up since he took over, and yet we're still making political maps the same way we were a decade ago. Does this mean the concept of an independent map-making process is dead?
On paper, we all want that. People who want good government want that. But, you know, just the sort of the naked fact of politics is that, you know, the party that controls, you know, the governor's mansion and the General Assembly during a remap year is going to write the maps that suit its partisan interests. It's just, it's not probably the best, loftiest way of governing, but it's inevitable.
To shift to McLean County politics, the county board is setting up its own legislative maps. A Democrat on the board, Elizabeth Johnston, proposed doubling county board districts from 10 to 20 while keeping the board at 20 members. The argument was the public would get more focused attention from one county board member. Several Democrats and allies spoke in support of this. A majority of public speakers, though, including some from rural areas in smaller towns, the more conservative Republican leaning went the opposite direction. They want fewer districts so each voter could elect a greater share of the county board. So this clearly follows ideological lines. Why do you think that might be?
I guess it doesn't necessarily, to me, lead to a clear ideological, you know, split. I mean, other than, you know, perhaps, you know, Republicans tend to be more skeptical of government, more suspicious of government. You know, I'm trying to think through exactly why there would be a sharp partisan division. And it's, no, there's no real obvious answer. I mean, other than, you know, the kind of powerful force in American politics now that once one party comes down for a position or a perspective, the other party almost reflexively takes the other position.
And critics of the 20 district plan say they fear it could be an attempt to defund services that mean more to rural residents, such as police protection for them. For many of them, the sheriff's office is all they have in that area. Is it plausible that that would be easier to do under a one board member per district format?
You know, I think, you know, rural America is not convinced that government works for them. They feel like they don't get enough government services, and they're suspicious that the services that they have are tenuously provided and will be quick to be removed if power configurations change.
That was John Shaw from the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute with Eric Stock. Shaw says he expects Democrats will also try to help Democratic incumbents Sherry Bustos and Lauren Underwood by redrawing the maps to put more Democrats in their districts after they both narrowly won last year. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Bloomington singer-songwriter Brett Conlon says a three-month isolation at home with his family last spring became the fodder for his recent acoustic EP, The Great Divide. Conlon tells John Norton the songs he wrote spoke to a nation at a loss for words during the events of 2020.
Definitely the song All American Reality Show and The Great Divide. Those were the two big ones that I wrote last spring, just sitting around where I was like, I feel like I need to say something. Like, I want to put it in a real good, intelligent song form instead of just another status or another rant.
Well, the warehouse closed down on our side of town. Living on this state check is rough. When we ask if you're able to help with food on our table, you say we didn't try hard enough.
Let's talk about specifically this song then. You write that it's kind of a fascination with the reality show president we just had.
And there's a lot of other things in the verses that I kind of touched on too that are all, I think, just overall problems that we're having, and they all kind of boiled over in 2020. for the past 4 years, we've had this train wreck that we couldn't look away from as a country. Whether you were pro-Trump or anti-Trump, I think everybody was still paying attention the whole time.
So what was your takeaway? How did you handle that in 2020?
For me, it was tough because I was out of work for about 3 months. And so we were just home, my girlfriend and I and the kids. I think I just kept looking for that light at the end of the tunnel. I kept saying, I think, all right, it won't get any worse than this.
And he kept surprising you.
Yeah, I'll give him that.
You just want the attention, and didn't we mention your land has all been reassigned? All children's hands couldn't meet their demands, so it seems where nothing will grow.
Did you have any reservations diving into deeply political material like this?
Absolutely. I don't think I've done anything like that before. So, and I think anybody that knows me knows that I am an advocate for middle ground stuff. I want everybody to appreciate each other and to come together when we can. So I tried really hard to dive into that without doing any name calling, without really like insulting anyone personally or anything like that, because I didn't think that was necessary. But I think I still got to the point, and I think people still realize, okay, this is what he's thinking. I was like, if I can just be bold enough just to say what I think, but not be overly, you know, vicious about it, I think that was the key.
Franchise church in our town wants to help you when you're down. A free sticker for your car that won't go. If you've got some cash to give, they'll tell you how to live. Stream live from their tax haven.
The song you're hearing is All American Reality Show by our guest Brett Conlon. It's from his great new EP called The Great Divide, which let's go to the title track.
When do we get back to normal? That's all anybody says anymore.
Yeah, those first couple lines in the song were just born out of frustration. I'm not one usually for small talk, so having that conversation over and over and over again with people, I was like, yeah, I get it. Everybody wants to go back to normal, but a good amount of people that don't want to contribute to what it's going to take to get back to their quote unquote normal.
And you personally took a hit. You own a barbershop in downtown Bloomington, and you said you had to shut down for 3 months.
Yeah, I was shut down from mid-March until June. You know, it's good that I do run a barbershop for my day job because I get both perspectives all the time. And so it's kind of made me appreciate both sides of it. But for me personally, it was making a choice. Okay, do I want to be a business that is on the forefront of being safe and do that as long as I need to, which was 3 months until we could be back open? Or do I want to be one of the businesses that's trying to kind of rebel against the guidelines?
Well, at least we got to get drunk at a beer garden before we start the next civil war.
It's the title track to the new album by Brett Conlon. It's an EP. It's called The Great Divide. We've talked politics over the last couple of songs, and I guess the next song I want to ask is certainly politically charged, but you took a female perspective on this. It's called The Wish the Well.
How did it come to this? I confused fervor with forever. It was just a few nights of bliss.
This is about political and religious leaders trying to control women's bodies, and you said you wanted to take a female perspective on this one. What did you find when you got into that space?
How do I make you see?
That I was not in touch with that space at all, so I had to do many, many revisions. I wrote the whole song, and then I sent it to my friend Jared Grab, who I also play in a band with, and he said, if you're trying to write from the female perspective, I don't think you're hitting the mark yet. I think what I had written was kind of like the first couple songs where it was sarcastic, kind of a little bit witty and things like that. But he's like, if you're trying to tap into this female character and perspective, you've got to go softer. You've got to be more emotional. You've got to be more direct still. But once I knew that, now I feel like I can tap into this character in the song. As a man, I'm not going to feel what that feels like. But I played it for my girlfriend and some other female friends of mine, songwriter friends of mine, and they were happy with it. The one thing I didn't want to do was mansplain a song about women's rights to women, you know?
And I don't know
The new album is called The Great Divide. Brett Conlon, great to catch up with you, man. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, John. It's good to talk to you again.
That's Bloomington singer-songwriter Brett Conlon speaking with John Norton. His new EP, The Great Divide, is available at his Bandcamp page and the usual streaming sites. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas and WGLT Normal, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Ryan Denham, and we had story help today from Dana Vollmer, Eric Stock, and John Norton. This is 89.1 FM, WGLT, and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.